Usually when we look at a bridge, we think we understand exactly what makes it strong.
Right, it seems pretty obvious.
Yeah, like imagine you are walking across a massive suspension bridge, say the Golden Gate. You feel the wind, you feel that slight sway of the deck beneath your feet, and you look around to reassure yourself.
Surely.
You see the massive steel beams painted in that iconic international orange. You see the thick concrete pillars anchored deep into the bedrock. And you see those heavy braided suspension cables, like thicker than a person's torso. And you point at the steel and you say, well, there it is. That's the strength.
Exactly. You treat the bridge as a collection of really sturdy, independent objects.
Right. And psychologically, that makes perfect sense. I mean, humans evolved to track objects. We track the tiger in the brush. We track the apple on the tree. We are totally wired for object permanence.
It's a profoundly intuitive way to view the world, really. We inherently trust things we can touch, measure, weigh, categorize.
If I can hold it, I get it.
Right, or at least if I can point to it, I feel like I understand it. We build our entire mental models of reality out of these discrete building blocks.
But then you actually sit down and talk to a structural engineer, and they will tell you something that completely shatters that illusion.
They absolutely will.
They tell you that the steel and the concrete are just the visible consequences of the bridge. The actual bridge, the underlying reality keeping thousands of cars from plummeting into the freezing water, is the invisible tension.
It is the hidden continuous web of relationships between the materials.
Exactly. The compression, the shear forces, the dynamic load distribution. And if a city planner or, a maintenance crew focuses only on the concrete objects,
Like just painting the steel and patching the concrete.
yeah, while completely ignoring the invisible relational tension, well, that is exactly how bridges collapse completely without warning on a random Tuesday afternoon.
It is the absolute definition of a structural blind spot. I mean, we mistake the physical components for the system itself.
And as long as the components look fine on the surface, we just assume the system is healthy.
Which is incredibly dangerous.
So, what if the way we look at reality as a collection of separate objects, things, and variables is completely backward?
That is the big question.
Welcome to today's deep dive. Our mission today is to explore a framework from a staggering, just paradigm-shifting paper. It's titled, From Entanglement to Governance, the Geometry of Coherence Across Scales.
It's a brilliant piece of work.
Well, you're going to deconstruct exactly why complex systems like the human body, global ecosystems, the international economy, and even entire governments keep failing.
Despite our ever-increasing ability to supposedly measure and control them.
Right. Okay, let's unpack this because the source material we have today is incredibly dense. I mean, it dives deep into advanced mathematics, topology, physics. But it holds a mirror up to every single aspect of our daily lives.
The scope is truly breathtaking.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating here is the core insight the author presents right at the very beginning to just sort of ground us, that systems do not fail because of a sudden external shock.
Wait, really? But we always blame the shock.
I know, we love to blame the black swan event. We blame the sudden market crash, the unexpected virus, the freak storm. But that is a myth.
A myth we tell ourselves to feel better.
Exactly, to feel better when things go wrong. The reality is that complex systems fail because their underlying hidden relational structure degrades slowly, like over years or decades, long before any observable metric changes.
And this paper uses the deepest levels of geometry and algebra to prove that everything from quantum entanglement in theoretical physics to devastating economic crises on Wall Street shares the exact same mathematical blueprint of breakdown.
It's a massive, almost unbelievable claim.
Right. To sit there and say that a subatomic particle winking in and out of existence and a housing market crashing are governed by the exact same geometric rules of failure, it's wild.
It is, but to even begin to understand why these systems fail, the text insists we first have to unlearn something. We have to unlearn what it calls our object-based ontology.
Okay, that's a very fancy philosophical term.
It is, but it basically just means this idea that the world is made of distinct, independent things. We have to learn a completely new language, what the author calls the grammar of coherence.
So we have to start with the total dissolution of the object.
Precisely. The text argues fiercely that objects are not primary. They are not the fundamental building blocks of the universe.
So what are they?
What you and I call an object is merely a stable pattern within a vast web of relations.
And this is most sharply posed and actually proven in modern physics, right?
Yes. If you look at the relational interpretation of quantum mechanics, entanglement isn't some weird, spooky exception to the rules of the universe.
Because for a long time, physicists treated entanglement as this bizarre edge case.
Exactly. But the math now suggests that entanglement is the default state of reality.
Right. The paper explicitly says that what we call a particle, which, you know, we've always visualized as a tiny, hard billiard ball orbiting a nucleus, is just a persistent projection of quantum relations.
It's not a thing. It is a pattern of correlations that happens to hold its shape long enough for our instruments to point at it and give it a name.
Oh, wow.
Think about a whirlpool in a river. Is the whirlpool an object?
I mean, you can point to it. You can measure its diameter. You can track its speed.
But there is no whirlpool substance.
Right.
It is entirely a relational pattern of water molecules flowing through a specific geometry. If the flow stops, the whirlpool vanishes.
It has no independent existence outside of its relations.
Exactly. An observation in this framework isn't a detached scientist looking at a separate static thing through a microscope. The observer and the observed are not distinct.
They are components of a larger entangled relational configuration.
Yes. Stability replaces substance as the criterion of existence.
Mm-hmm.
An electron, a biological cell, a financial institution, none of these are substances in isolation.
They are patterns of relations that hold. And when the invisible constraints that hold them are violated, the pattern degrades and the object just disappears.
You've got it.
Okay, I need to push back here, though, because my brain is really struggling to let go of the building blocks.
That's completely normal.
If I force myself to think only in terms of relationships instead of objects, my mind immediately defaults to pairs. Two things connecting. Cause and effect, supply and demand. A relates to B. A predator eats a prey item.
Sure. Guides.
Right. Why isn't a pair enough? Why can't we just build a perfectly accurate model of the universe based on pairs of things interacting with each other?
It is a very natural assumption. And honestly, the vast majority of modern science, economics, statistics, it's all built on exactly that pairwise assumption.
We look for the correlation between two variables.
Right. Force between two bodies.
Mm-hmm.
But the source text asserts mathematically that pairs are structurally insufficient to build a coherent reality.
Really? Why?
A pair can relate, yes, but it cannot close. It lacks internal closure.
What do you mean by closure? Like, it can't self-correct.
Exactly that. A pairwise relation cannot detect its own contradiction or breakdown.
Oh, I see.
If you only have element A relating to element B, there is no internal reference point by which that relationship can be validated. Think of a simple transaction. I hand you a piece of paper, and you hand me an apple.
Okay, that's a pair.
But is it a valid economic exchange? We don't know. You need a third element, a currency system, or a mutual understanding of value, or a legal framework to provide the context that makes that exchange meaningful and stable.
So triadic closure. A relates to B, B relates to C, and C routes back to A.
Yes, triadic closure is the absolute minimal unit of consistency in the universe. With three elements, relations form a loop.
So the relation between A and B is suddenly constrained and validated by their shared relations to C.
Exactly. The system can now internally evaluate its own consistency.
So it creates a feedback loop. A checks B, B checks C, C checks A. If one of those links is broken, the whole triad instantly registers that something is wrong.
Precisely. You need at least three elements for a system to be able to detect its own breakdown. The triad is the absolute minimal unit of closure.
Below three, you just have open-ended blind interactions.
Exactly.
But the paper doesn't stop at three. It expands this concept out to a fully formed architecture. It calls this the seven primitives of relational coherence.
This is where it gets really practical.
Yeah. The author argues that for any complex system to persist in the real world, whether it's a living cell or a multinational corporation, it requires exactly seven irreducible roles.
And we can't skip any of them.
Right. I don't want to just list these off like a textbook. So let's actually try to build a system together to see why we need all seven.
Sounds good. What kind of system?
Let's take something relatively simple but dynamic. A home thermostat system.
Oh, I love that. A perfect, relatable, cybernetic system. Where do we start?
Well, the first primitive the text gives us is constraint. This is what limits and defines the system.
So in our thermostat, the constraint is the physical wiring, the walls of the house keeping the air in, the sheer physical reality that defines what the system even is.
Right. Without constraint, the system has no identity. It dissolves into the environment.
Exactly. Now, the second primitive is margin. This is what allows for tolerance/buffering.
So a thermostat doesn't click the heater on the millisecond. The temperature drops by 1/1000th of a degree.
No, it waits until it's maybe 1 or 2 degrees too cold. That buffer is the margin. If a system has zero margin, it shatters at the very first microscopic stress.
Okay, the third is state. This is just the current reality. Like, it's 68 degrees in the hallway. It's what currently is.
But systems don't exist in a vacuum, which brings us to the fourth primitive, which is disturbance.
This is the perturbation from the outside. A cold front moves in, or someone leaves the front door wide open in the middle of winter. The environment forces a change on the state.
And the system has to know that happened, which is our fifth primitive, perception.
Now, a thermostat isn't conscious, but it still has perception. The bimetal strip inside it physically bends as the air gets colder. It interprets the disturbance.
And this is where many people get tripped up. They think perception requires a brain.
Right, like consciousness.
But in relational architecture, perception is simply the capacity of the system to register a meaningful change in its environment. A plant tilting toward the sun is perception.
Ah, okay. Without it, the disturbance happens, but the system is blind to it.
Exactly.
Once it perceives the drop in temperature, it needs the sixth primitive, regulation. This is the response. The thermostat sends an electrical signal to the furnace to fire up.
It is the active countermeasure to the disturbance.
Right. Finally, we have the seventh primitive, options. This is the repertoire of possible responses.
The furnace can turn on, it can turn off, or maybe in a smart home, it can turn on the ceiling fans to push warm air down. The system must have a menu of potential actions.
So we have our seven: constraint, margin, state, disturbance, perception, regulation, and options. And what the author insists upon is that seven is not an arbitrary number.
Not at all.
Yeah.
If you try to build a system with only five or six of these, it mathematically cannot survive.
It's an issue of functional completeness.
Yes. Each of these seven roles addresses a strict mathematical requirement for persistence. Remove perception, the system is blind.
Remove options, the system is paralyzed.
Remove margin, the system is hopelessly brittle.
But these seven primitives aren't just sitting in a bucket. They have to talk to each other. They form specific interlocking triads, like functional channels.
The text mentions the geometry of a viability, which is the specific triad of constraint, margin, and state.
Right. They work together in a closed loop to define what is safely possible for the system.
Precisely. The state is checked against the constraint and buffered by the margin. And there are other triads. There is the response channel, which is the loop connecting state, disturbance, and regulation.
And the possibility mapping connecting state, perception, and options. Every single one of the seven roles participates in multiple triads, and every triad intersects with the others.
No role is left hanging. It is a completely closed, perfectly interwoven relational structure.
Okay, so if we have exactly seven roles, and they must all connect to each other via closed triads in a perfectly balanced loop, what does that shape actually look like?
If we draw it, what are we looking at?
Yeah. Which brings us to the geometry of coherence.
This is where the math gets incredibly elegant. When you take exactly seven elements and you require them to arrange themselves so that every single pair of points is completed by a third point in a closed triad.
Mathematics dictates that there is only one possible configuration in the universe.
It is uniquely determined. It is a structure known as the Fano plane.
Let me try to paint a vivid picture of this Fano plane for you because it's a really beautiful image. Imagine a triangle drawn on a piece of paper, just a standard equal-sided triangle.
Okay, got it.
Now, from each of the three corners, draw a straight line straight across to the middle of the opposite side. Those three lines will all intersect perfectly in the exact center of the triangle.
Right, basic geometry so far.
Now, we are going to place our seven primitives as points on this drawing. Place a point at each of the three corners. Place a point in the middle of each of the three outer sides, and place your seventh point dead center where the lines cross.
That's our seven roles: constraint, margin, state, and so on.
Exactly. You can clearly see the straight lines connecting these points in sets of three, triads. But to connect the three points sitting on the flat sides of the triangle, you have to draw a circle inscribed inside the triangle.
In that detail, the circle that is not a circle is fiercely important.
Why draw a circle?
Because in flat two-dimensional Euclidean geometry, you simply cannot draw a straight line through those three points. The fact that we have to use a circle to represent a triadic line proves that this geometry is not flat. The Fano plane is a projective plane.
So it's a mathematically pure structure that cannot be fully flattened out into our normal 3D spatial intuition without bending a line into a circle. It's like trying to perfectly flatten a peeled orange spin on a table. It tears or it folds. The Fenno plane is telling us that the deep, foundational geometry of coherence doesn't fit neatly into the physical space we walk around in.
We're looking at a projection of a deeper, higher-dimensional relational structure.
That is wild.
And in this perfect Fenno plane, every single pair of points lies on exactly one line, meaning every pair is part of exactly one triad. No relation is unmonitored.
No action goes unchecked.
But as beautiful as this geometry is, structure alone is static. A drawing of a bridge doesn't explain how the bridge handles rush hour traffic.
Right. To understand how coherence evolves, adapts, or ultimately fails, we have to look at how things move across this structure. We have to move from geometry to algebra.
Yes. And the author points out something that feels almost like magic here.
Oh, this part blew my mind.
If you take this Fenno plane and you assign an orientation to it, meaning you draw little arrows on the lines to show the direction of flow, representing actions taking place.
This simple geometric drawing perfectly encodes the multiplication rules for a bizarre eight-dimensional number system called the Octonians.
The Octonians are an extension of the complex numbers.
Right.
And they are notorious in mathematics because they lose a property that we all take for granted.
Which is associativity.
Exactly.
Okay, I have to jump in and really unpack this because this mathematical pushback is the crux of the whole breakdown theory.
It really is.
In normal math, like the math we all learned in elementary school, associativity is a given law of the universe. If I have three numbers, say A, B, and C, and I want to multiply them together, if I multiply A times B first and then take that result and multiply it by C, I will get the exact same answer as if I had multiplied B times C first and then multiplied A by that result.
The grouping simply doesn't matter.
Right. A times B times C equals A times B times C. That's associativity. So why on earth are we throwing that fundamental rule out the window?
We throw it out because in a complex relational system, you aren't dealing with inert, independent objects like the number 5 or the number 10.
You are dealing with active, interdependent relationships.
And in the real world of relationships, the order and grouping of actions fundamentally change the outcome.
Let me try a real-world analogy for this. Think about getting dressed in the morning. Your elements are your foot, which is A, your sock, B, and your shoe, C.
Okay, I see where this is going.
If you group the foot and the sock first, you put the sock on your foot, and then you group the shoe over that, you are ready for work.
A very successful outcome.
But if you group the sock and the shoe first, you put the sock over the outside of your shoe and then try to put your foot into that mess, you have a completely different, totally incoherent outcome. Grouping matters.
That is a brilliant, tactile way to understand it. When actions are relational, the sequence of composition alters the reality of the state.
So let's apply it back to our cybernetic thermostat system.
Okay, so say you have a disturbance, like a window opens, a margin, which is your buffer, and a regulation, the heater.
Right. If the system checks the margin first, realizes it's still within the buffer, and then decides to hold off on regulation, the system stays calm.
But if the system applies regulation to the disturbance first, firing the heater instantly and only afterward checks the margin, the house rapidly overheats and energy is wasted.
The grouping completely altered the systemic outcome.
Exactly. The difference between those two outcomes, the gap between the first grouping and the second grouping, is a mathematical value called the associator.
So the associator is basically a friction sensor.
That's a great way to put it.
It's a mathematical test to measure how sensitive the system is becoming to the grouping of its actions. You run the math both ways. If you subtract one outcome from the other and the result is exactly zero, it means the grouping didn't matter.
The system flowed perfectly.
But if the result is anything other than zero, it means the grouping changed the outcome.
Precisely. The associator is the ultimate diagnostic tool for the health of a complex system.
So if the associator equals zero, the local triads are operating consistently.
The relationships are composing without distortion. The system is highly coherent. But the moment that associator becomes non-zero, it is a glaring red flashing light.
It signals a breakdown.
The triad has become highly sensitive to grouping. Different relational pathways are producing incompatible, conflicting outcomes. The system is experiencing deep internal structural tension.
And what absolutely blows my mind about this paper is that the author emphasizes that this non-associativity isn't a bug in the code of reality.
No, it's a vital feature.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Non-associativity is the system's built-in early warning mechanism.
It is the only way a completely enclosed system can detect its own loss of coherence.
Because without this non-zero associator creating internal friction, all relational combinations would blindly appear consistent.
The system would have no internal diagnostic whatsoever, and the failure would be utterly invisible right up until the moment the entire structure catastrophically shattered.
Okay, let's just pause and digest that. The universe has a built-in alarm bell for structural tension.
It really does.
So if complex systems like global banking or oceanic ecosystems or the human immune system have this built-in warning system constantly flagging relational friction, why are we humans always so totally blindsided when things collapse?
It's a fair question.
Why does a stock market crash always feel like it came out of nowhere? Why does a coral reef suddenly bleach and die in a single season?
Because, quite simply, we're staring blindly at the wrong things.
We are not measuring the underlying relations.
We are completely ignoring the associator. We are obsessively measuring the surface variables. And this brings us to what I consider the most critical, actionable concept in the entire paper.
And that is the mathematical distinction between observable reality and structural reality.
The author formalizes this massive distinction using an advanced topological concept called fiber bundles.
Let's walk the listener through this slowly. What exactly are the components of a fiber bundle, and why does this explain our blind spots?
So a fiber bundle is a mathematical space that looks locally like a simple product of spaces, but globally can have a twisted, complex structure. For our purposes, it consists of three vital elements.
Okay, element number one.
First, you have the base space. Think of this as the observable states, the variables we can easily see, measure, and record on a spreadsheet.
These are lab vitals like blood pressure or economic indicators like GDP and stock prices or ecological metrics like a raw headcount of deer in a forest.
It's the dashboard.
Exactly. Okay, what's the second element?
Second, you have the fiber. This is the hidden, high-dimensional, intensely complex relational structure we've been talking about. It's the actual phenoplanes.
It is the intricate web of constraints, margins, social trust, metabolic pathways, and adaptive capacities that actually keep the system alive and running.
Exactly. And third, you have the projection. This is the mathematical mapping, the function that crushes the incredibly complex fiber down into the simple, readable base space.
Let me use an analogy here, because when I read the section of the paper, it immediately made me think of making shadow puppets on a wall.
Oh, I like this.
So imagine you have a bright flashlight shining on your hands, casting a shadow on a blank wall.
Okay.
The base space, the observable reality, the dashboard, is the flat 2D shadow on the wall. Let's say you've arranged your hands so the shadow looks exactly like a perfectly formed bird in flight. It looks stable, graceful, and solid.
Right. That's what we can see.
The fiber, the hidden relational structure, is the wildly complex three-dimensional biological arrangement of your actual hands.
Mm-hmm.
It's the joints, the muscles, the exact tension in your pinky finger, the angle of the flashlight, the distance from the wall.
So many more variables.
And the projection is simply the light rays traveling past your hands to create the flat shadow.
Perfect.
Now, here is the absolute kicker. Multiple, entirely different, and potentially degrading hand shapes in the fiber can cast the exact same bird shadow on the base space. You could be starting to cramp up. Your fingers could be trembling with exhaustion. You could be seconds away from dropping your arms entirely in pain. But the 2D shadow on the wall still looks like a perfect, stable, peaceful bird.
That is a phenomenal analogy because it perfectly captures what the text defines as the error of reification.
And here's where it gets really interesting. The biggest, most devastating mistake humanity makes across almost every single domain of science, economics, and governance is treating the projection as the totality of the system.
We look at the 2D shadow on the wall and we confidently declare, that is the system. The bird is fine.
Yes. And because of the math of projections, multiple structural states in the hidden fiber map to the identical measurement in the base space.
A system's internal relational structure can be rotting from the inside out. The associated friction is skyrocketing. The margins, those buffer zones are shrinking to zero. The constraints are warping.
But the observable projection stays completely static. The lab vitals look perfectly healthy. The corporate quarterly earnings are up. The shadow bird looks flawless.
Right up until the absolute final millisecond.
Exactly. And when the structural tension in the fiber finally exceeds its ultimate limit, the projection shifts violently. The shadow bird vanishes.
To the observer who is only watching the wall, it looks like a sudden, unpredictable, catastrophic collapse. a black swan.
But the collapse wasn't sudden at all. It is merely the final, unavoidable projection of a long-hidden incoherence that has been growing in the fiber for years.
The failure was baked into the system from the very moment we mistook the projection for the structure.
Wow. Okay, so if the base space, our dashboard of GDP, blood pressure, test scores, is essentially lying to us, or at least heavily hiding the truth, how do we ever measure the health of the hidden fiber before it collapses?
That is the million-dollar question.
If we know we can't just look at the surface variables, what do we actually look for?
Well, if you want to know if the fiber is tearing apart, you have to look at how the local parts of the system connect, or glue, together.
Mm.
You have to stop looking at averages and start looking at boundaries.
And the mathematical framework for this is called sheaf theory.
Yes, and it tracks the critical difference between local consistency and global coherence.
Sheaf theory. Okay, let's unpack how this gluing works.
A sheaf is an incredibly powerful mathematical tool that asks a specific localized question. Do locally consistent pieces of a system smoothly form a globally coherent structure?
Because in any real-world system, we humans only ever observe parts. We never see the whole universe at once. We measure locally.
A doctor looks at a specific organ. A manager looks at a specific department.
But local coherence does not guarantee global coherence.
Not at all. You can have a complex system where every single local triad, every single department appears to be operating perfectly fine on its own. But when you try to combine their realities together, their relationships violently conflict.
Imagine taking 5 close-up photos of a beautiful mountain landscape with your smartphone. You take a picture of a peak, a picture of the valley, a picture of a cabin. Each individual photo, which the math would call a local section, looks flawless. The exposure is great. The focus is razor sharp. Nothing is wrong with the photo.
Locally, it's perfect.
But then you use your phone's software to stitch those 5 photos together into a wide panorama. This is the global section.
Right.
Suddenly, the software completely fails. Because you move your hands slightly between shots, the stitched panorama shows a mountain hanging upside down, a pine tree is sheared in half, and a dog walking through the frame now has 2 heads.
The local consistency of each photo was absolutely there, but the global coherence was completely obstructed. They simply refused to glue together.
That failure to glue is the essence of systemic breakdown.
And mathematics is a very specific way to measure this failure. It's called cohomology.
Cohomology is the formal measure of obstruction.
When local sections of a system fail to glue together perfectly, the math detects a topological hole or an obstruction in the space.
Let's make this brutally real. Think about the 2008 global financial crisis.
Oh, a perfect example.
Let's map this onto sheaf theory. Locally, a mortgage broker in Florida writes a terrible loan to someone who can't afford it. But locally, it's consistent for them. They get their commission check. The system works.
Then, a massive bank buys that loan, bundles it with thousands of others, and pays a rating agency to stamp it as an AAA safe investment.
Locally, the bank is making record profits, and the rating agency gets their fee. The local sections are perfectly consistent. The base space, the stock market projection is roaring higher than ever.
Right. But globally, the entire thing is a massive gaping topological hole.
Exactly. The cohomology class was wildly non-zero. The local truths, I got my commission, we sold the bond, completely failed to glue to the global reality, which was the actual human beings living in these houses cannot pay the underlying mortgages.
The associative friction between the real economy and the financial sector was screaming. But because everyone from the Federal Reserve to the day traders was only looking at the base space projection, that rising stock index, they didn't see the massive cohomological obstruction growing in the fiber.
So what this proves is that early warning signals of a collapse aren't about waiting for a specific metric to drop.
No, not at all.
It's not about waiting for a fever to spike or a stock price to plummet, because by the time the projection drops, the bridge has already collapsed.
Early warning is about measuring rising cohomological obstruction.
It's looking for increased variability. It's noticing a loss of synchrony between different departments in a company or different biological systems in a body.
It's observing a delayed recovery from minor disturbances. It's the system showing you that its panorama photo is starting to misalign long before the whole picture shatters.
Precisely. Crisis is not an event. Crisis is the quiet accumulation of unresolved inconsistencies. Failure begins, mathematically and physically, as an inability to glue.
This is a heavy realization. It feels like we are surrounded by failing sheaves.
It really does. But I want to pivot toward the positive. If cohomology mathematically measures the failure and the obstruction, what measures the ultimate success?
What's the goal line?
Yeah, what is the holy grail metric that tells us a complex system will survive, adapt, and persist through chaos?
To find the mathematics of true persistence, we have to follow the author deeper down the rabbit hole. We have to look at what the text calls the exceptional ladder.
Okay, the exceptional ladder.
This is a very specific mathematical progression, a ladder of abstract lifts to find the ultimate scalar measure of viability.
We're going to walk through this ladder, and I promise we will translate the math as we go because the implications are stunning. We started at the Fano plane, right? That gave us our minimal relational closure, the baseline geometry of 7 points.
Then we lifted or upgraded to the Octonians, which gave us the non-associative algebra.
The operational rules of how those points interact and create friction.
But the Octonians only give us local algebra. They don't give us a structured state space to map out an entire system's potential.
So the mathematics forces us to make another lift to something called the Albert algebra, often denoted as J3 of O.
Let's translate Albert algebra.
What
does this upgrade actually give our system?
It expands the architecture. Instead of just tracking an operation, the Albert algebra gives us a 27-dimensional structured state space.
And crucially, it comes with a cubic determinant.
You can think of a determinant as a measure of volume. In this case, it measures the volume of possibilities available to the system.
As long as this cubic determinant is non-zero, the system has volume. It has room to maneuver, adapt, and breathe.
If that determinant collapses to zero, the system's possibility space flattens out, and it's dead.
But even 27 dimensions isn't enough to capture the full breathing reality of a complex system reacting to a chaotic universe.
Because a system isn't just its current state, it's also its momentum, its potential, its boundaries.
Correct. To fully describe a dynamic system, you need to know where it is and where it is going. In physics, we call this position and momentum.
To capture both simultaneously, the math forces one final structural lift to the Freudenthal triple system.
This introduces a concept called symplectic duality, essentially.
Yeah.
The perfect mathematical mirroring of action and reaction, state and potential.
It expands the space to a massive 56 dimensions. And it is here, in this deeply complex, vibrating mathematical space, that we finally find what we are looking for.
An ultimate prize.
A quartic invariant, specifically the E7 quartic invariant.
Let's break down the word invariant. In physics, an invariant is something that stays absolutely the same no matter how much the system around it changes, moves, or transforms.
The easiest example is the conservation of energy. You can take a solid log of wood, throw it in a fire, and burn it until it is completely transformed into ash, smoke, gas, and radiating heat.
The physical form is completely destroyed.
But if you measure all the heat, the light, the gas, and the ash, the total energy of the system remains exactly the same as when it was a log. The energy is invariant. It survives the transformation.
Yes, exactly. And the E7 quartic invariant is a degree 4 mathematical function that remains unchanged under a vast, dizzying group of relational transformations.
In this theoretical framework, this invariant is the ultimate scalar measure of systemic viability.
It integrates everything we've talked about. The current state, the dynamic response to disturbance, the scalar boundaries, the margins, and the deep cross-couplings of the entire 56-dimensional relational system.
It doesn't rely on a single perspective or a flat 2D projection.
If a system faces a massive shock and it morphs, shifts, and adapts to survive, but this quartic invariant is preserved,
the system lives. It retains its deep structural coherence, even if it looks completely different on the outside.
But if this invariant degrades, the core relational integrity is lost, the associative friction tears the triads apart, and the system dies.
Okay, I have to push back again here and maybe nerd out a little bit.
Go for it.
Because if you read up on this specific area of exceptionally deep mathematics, you know that E7 is not the end of the line. There is a larger, much more famous exceptional symmetry group that sits above it, E8.
Ah, E8.
It is an absolutely massive 248-dimensional structure. It is so complex and beautiful that some theoretical physicists have literally tried to use E8 as the theory of everything, the ultimate God equation of the universe that unites gravity and quantum mechanics.
That's true. It has a lot of mystique.
So my question is, if E7 measures viability, isn't E8 the ultimate answer? Shouldn't we be striving to preserve E8?
It is so tempting to make that leap. But it is crucial that we do not fall into that trap.
Yeah.
The author of the paper explicitly cautions against that kind of mathematical hubris.
Why is that?
E8 does not give us a higher degree invariant of the same type as E7. You don't get a better health bar. What EA represents is the maximal constraint structure of reality itself.
It is the absolute boundary of what can be formally structured without collapsing into mathematical contradiction.
So if E7 tells us how well the system is playing the game and surviving,
E8 defines the outer boundary of the game board itself.
That is a perfect way to conceptualize it. E8 marks the limit of what can be formalized. Beyond E8, mathematics cannot guide our interpretation directly.
It demands a discipline of interpretation. We shouldn't naively map E8 directly onto a corporate org chart or a biological pathway.
It simply stands as a sentinel, telling us that viability and coherence must operate within ultimate constraints that simply cannot be surpassed.
All right, this math is staggering. It's beautiful, it's elegant, but I will admit it is highly abstract. So let's bring it crashing down into the dirt of reality.
Yes, let's apply it.
We are going to apply this exact same blueprint. The Fano plane, the fiber bundle, the sheaf failure, the cohomology, to four massive, tangible domains of human existence.
We want to prove that this isn't just a chalkboard theory. This is exactly how the world around us is currently operating and currently failing.
Let's start with domain one, medicine and physiology. This is perhaps the most personal application.
In a modern clinical setting, what is the base space? What is the projection we look at? It is the lab vitals. It is the blood pressure reading, the fasting glucose levels, the BMI, the resting heart rate.
That is the dashboard.
But what is the fiber? The hidden fiber is the unbelievably complex, multi-system regulatory network of the human body.
It is homeostasis. It's the interplay between your immune response, your gut microbiome, your hormonal balance, your stress levels, and your sleep quality.
And what does modern allopathic medicine usually do? It optimizes the projections.
If you go to the doctor and you have high blood pressure in the base space, the primary protocol is to give you a chemical pill that artificially forces that specific variable down into a normal range.
But meanwhile, the underlying relational breakdown in the fiber, the poor diet, the chronic cortisol from a stressful job, the non-zero associator causing the actual disease is completely ignored. The root friction continues to degrade.
Precisely. In this framework, chronic disease is the physiological expression of non-associativity. Regulatory pathways in the body start conflicting. The metabolic triads fail to close.
But because the base space vitals are being chemically forced to look perfect, the doctor looks at the chart and thinks the patient is fine. Your numbers look great.
But the clinical collapse, the sudden fatal heart attack at age 50, is just the delayed projection of a fiber failure that has been silently accumulating topological holes for two decades.
That is absolutely terrifying, but it makes an uncomfortable amount of sense.
Okay, let's look at domain two, ecology, and the biosphere. Here, our base space, the dashboard environmentalists and governments look at, is the species count, the gross biomass, the observable temperature of a region.
The hidden fiber is the incredibly complex trophic interaction networks. It's who eats whom, how nitrogen flows through the soil, the symbiotic relationship between fungi and tree roots, and crucially, the redundancy of the ecosystem.
And this is where the text points out a profoundly dangerous practice in human land management, the illusion of resilience.
In modern agriculture and environmental management, we are obsessed with maximizing efficiency. We look at a messy ancient forest and we say, there was too much wasted space here.
So we clear cut the diverse forest and plant a monoculture pine plantation. We remove the redundant scrub brush and insects.
Right. We optimize the base space. We maximize the timber yield variable.
But by removing that redundancy to gain efficiency, we are stripping away the margin, one of our absolute foundational seven primitive roles.
Remember, without margin, a system is hopelessly brittle. The pine plantation looks incredibly stable and vastly more productive than the old forest, right up until a minor disturbance hits.
A specific species of pine beetle moves in, and because there is no margin, no natural predators for the beetle, no genetic diversity to buffer the attack, the local sections fail to glue.
The entire forest is wiped out in a single season. The ecosystem was perfectly efficient on paper, but entirely structurally incoherent in reality.
Efficiency is often the enemy of coherence. Okay, let's move to domain three, economics and crisis. This one feels incredibly relevant to everyone listening.
The base space projection here is obvious. GDP, inflation rates, employment numbers, the S&P 500 index.
The hidden fiber is the real productive capacity of the society, the physical resilience of the supply chains, the ecological limits of the resources being extracted, and maybe most importantly, the invisible social trust between the citizens and the institutions.
Economic crises happen predictably because financial flows, the abstract numbers in the base space, are allowed to expand completely independently of the underlying relational capacity in the fiber.
This is a classic catastrophic sheaf failure. The financial sector might be completely locally consistent. Bankers are hitting their quarterly targets. Hedge funds are printing money.
But it completely fails to glue globally with the real production sector, the stagnating wages of the working class, or the ecological reality of a warming planet.
So the GDP can hit record-breaking historic highs while the real structural coherence of the society is in freefall.
Exactly. And the tension the associator stretches like a rubber band. And when the projection finally, inevitably snaps back to match the deeply degraded reality of the fiber.
You get the Great Depression, you get supply chain collapse during a pandemic. It looks like a sudden shock to the pundits on TV, but the mathematical obstruction had been rising loudly for a decade.
Which naturally brings us to domain four, governance and policy.
The base space here is political indicator targets. It's a mayor promising to reduce crime stats by 10%. It's a school board mandating higher standardized testing benchmarks. It's a nation signing a pledge to meet specific carbon emission quotas.
The fiber is the actual messy human institutional integrity, the cultural coherence, and the informal trust networks of the community.
This raises an important question, and it's the crux of the whole governance dilemma. How do we govern what we cannot fully see?
Because if the most important structural parts of a society exist in the hidden fiber, and all a politician or a CEO can actually see are the base space indicators on their desk,
yeah,
how do policymakers not constantly break the system?
The fundamental tragic error of modern governance is trying to control outcomes based on projections.
There is a famous concept called Goodhart's Law. When a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure.
When a government forces a complex system to hit a specific metric, like tying school funding to test scores, it inevitably distorts and breaks the relational structure to achieve it.
Teachers stop educating and start teaching to the test. The metric goes up, but the actual education of the child degrades.
The text insists passionately that we must shift our entire philosophical approach from control to navigation.
Navigation does not assume complete godlike knowledge of the system. Navigation works gently within constraints to preserve structural integrity rather than forcefully manipulating a variable to hit a predetermined target.
Which perfectly transitions us into part seven, the final piece of the puzzle. The author introduces a concept called wu-wei, action without forcing.
If control is fundamentally impossible because we mathematically can never see the full fiber, how are we actually supposed to act in the world?
How do we fix the climate or fix our economy or fix our own bodies? Do we just throw our hands up, give up, and let the system do whatever it wants?
Not at all. Wu Wei is an ancient Taoist concept, but in this paper, it is defined rigorously, mathematically, as structural alignment.
I want to be very clear about what Wu Wei is not. It is not passive acceptance. It is not apathy. It is not doing nothing.
Wu Wei is highly precise, deeply context-aware intervention. It means acting in a way that preserves or restores relational coherence without imposing an alien, incompatible structure from the outside.
It's surfing the wave instead of trying to command the ocean to be flat. It's realizing you cannot force the system to fit your 2D projection.
If you have a struggling, stagnant economy, you can't just print trillions of dollars and force the GDP variable up without absolutely destroying the hidden fiber of trust and value.
You have to align your actions with the system's inherent constraints. You preserve the margins. You protect the adaptive capacity.
You do the minimal, most elegant, necessary intervention to allow the system's own internal triads to reestablish their own coherence.
And this leads to the ultimate paradox of control, which the author highlights at the very end of the text.
The more we attempt to forcefully control complex systems based on their superficial projections, the less coherent and more fragile they become.
The harder we grip, the faster it shatters. Conversely, the more we let go of the variables and instead align our actions with the hidden relational structure, the more effective, resilient, and powerful our actions become.
Wu Wei is the operational daily expression of preserving that beautiful E7 quartic invariant.
Wow. Okay. Let's zoom out and summarize this incredible mind-bending journey.
We covered a lot of ground today.
We started at the absolute bottom of reality, at the quantum level, realizing that particles are just projections of entanglement. Objects are illusions.
We discovered that for any system to persist, it needs exactly seven relational roles locked into a triadic geometry called the Fano plane.
We learned that non-associativity, the associator, is the universe's built-in mathematical alarm bell of structural breakdown.
We saw how mistaking the observable base space for the hidden fiber leads to the devastating error of reification. We worshiped the shadow and ignored the hands.
We used sheaves and cohomology to mathematically prove that local success, a profitable bank, a clear-cut forest, can mask massive global obstruction, leading to sudden, catastrophic collapse.
And we traced this exact same geometric blueprint of breakdown through our own biology, our environment, our economy, and our political systems.
Realizing that survival in any domain isn't about desperately maintaining your variables, it's about preserving your coherence.
That's a completely different way to live in the world.
So, what does this all mean for you? I want you to think about your own life as a fiber bundle. Think about your career trajectory, your mental health, your marriage, your friendships.
All of it.
How often are you obsessively tracking your base space, your annual salary, your productivity metrics, the number of steps on your smartwatch, the number of likes on your latest post?
How often do you treat those numbers as the absolute truth of your well-being?
Meanwhile, your fiber, your actual day-to-day joy, your physical rest, your deep unspoken connections with the people you love, your margins for error when you make a mistake is silently degrading.
The associative friction in your life is flashing red, but you're ignoring it because your dashboard looks fine.
What would it look like tomorrow to stop trying to force the variables in your life to look perfect? What if you stopped treating yourself like an engineering project made of separate controllable objects to be optimized?
What if instead you practiced Wu Wei?
Navigating the underlying invisible coherence of who you actually are, preserving your margins, aligning with your constraints. You are not the concrete and the steel. You are the invisible tension that holds the bridge together. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Look beyond the projections, and we'll see you next time.